The Spark App Podcast, episode 21. This episode brought to you by Unexpected Business Travel. We're back. Welcome to the Spark App Podcast. I usually go by Carl.
And I am Corey, because our listeners may have forgotten.
Yeah, it's been a bit.
It has been a little while. As you could tell by our sponsor this week, both Carl and I were traveling, so we were unable to record some podcasts for you guys. But now we're back, and we are back in the studio.
Yeah, and the great thing about not getting paid anything to do this, nobody can fire us if we take off for a bit.
Very true. Yeah. Very true. Hopefully you guys will forgive us.
Yes, hopefully.
So, what do you want to talk about today, Carl?
I was thinking we could talk about PCB layout tips and tricks.
PCB layout tips and tricks. I like it because even if you are just a passerby in the hobbyist of hardware stuff, chances are you've tried to or you want to try to lay out your own board.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's it's kind of fun.
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to do this is because of the way I laid out my first board. So I took for credit a PCB layout class, but I didn't have any time to actually take the class. So I was told, hey, if you do all the projects, it doesn't really matter if you take the class or not. You'll still get credit. So I'm like, great. So I laid out a PCB. I actually laid out 13 PCBs, I think it was, total.
Wow.
Yeah. And I had no idea what I was doing. Everything was right angles. It was amazing that it worked.
Oh, because that was going to be my next question. How many of those 13 worked?
No, they all worked.
Okay.
But they're hideous. I have them in the garage, but I don't show them to people.
Yeah.
Because it's like, there's like 30 million vias on there. For no reason. Like it was like a two layer board, maybe a four layer. I think it was two layer, but it's like top, bottom, I mean, it's just terrible.
Yeah.
So I should have probably like watched a video or maybe listened to somebody.
Or actually gone to the class.
I think the class was probably pretty worthless. Now, I don't regret that decision ever. What I made at least worked. A lot of people just made like coasters, which is okay. Right. I've made a couple coasters.
Yeah.
I got lucky on the first one. Just not making, you know, made something that actually worked pretty well.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I took that same class just before you did, and I made a big old belt buckle, like a Texas style buckle, only it was a scrolling marquee of text that you could program.
Yeah, did it work?
Oh, it worked great.
Now, how many other people in the class's projects worked?
I don't recall.
Yeah, see, I don't have any numbers either because I never went to the class.
Oh, okay.
Like, I never. Well, I don't even know what room it was in. But I'm like, yeah, I can lay out PCBs. No big deal.
Yeah.
Well, and then I was using that Advanced Circuits. What is it?
PCB Artist.
Oh, yeah, PCB Artist. It goes by like a million different names. Like, every time you see on the web that there's some free, you know, layout software, it's like based off of that same PCB Artist. Like, I think one's like PCB 123 and a whole bunch of them, but it's all based off of PCB Artist, which I don't like.
I don't know. It's not a bad program, right? I mean, it's easy enough to get around. I should know. I laid out a ton of boards in that program for my graduate work. So, you know, but I guess it's kind of true for any program you use. If you use it enough and you get used to it, then it's easy to use.
Yeah. It's okay. The one thing I did like about it was when you were actually doing the layout, when you hovered over things, it would tell you the pin name. So not just like the signal net that you were on, it would also tell you the pin, which is pretty helpful because a lot of times that's kind of annoying. But that's about it.
I think what we should do is we'll probably have a follow-up episode to this one where we talk about tools for PCB layout.
Right.
Like different software packages and things like that. This week, we wanted to talk more about the actual practices during the layout.
Yeah. Now, it doesn't matter what package you're using, whether you're using KiCad or, you know, PCB Artist or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's just tips and tricks, hard-learned lessons, that kind of thing, to make a successful PCB board faster, easier, less stressful.
Yeah. So we're not really going to talk too much about stack up because we already mentioned that back, way back when we were.
Yeah, when we were talking about like traps that you can get into.
Yeah,
we
kind
of talked about how you can overthink stack up a bit. So we're not really going to. Stack up's a very personal decision, and I'm not going to tell anybody exactly how to do their stack up.
Fair enough. So let's start with the next thing that you should do, and that's
First thing.
Well, yeah, once you have your stack up all picked out and whatnot,
yeah,
is getting components on your board. Component placement. You got to put components on the board.
Yeah. Now, what I like to do is, well, before you decide on component placement, there is one decision you need to make. Are you going to have components on both sides of the board? Because that plays a huge role into where you're going to place these components.
That is very true. Now, there are pros and cons to that, right? So, plus of having components on both sides of the board.
Well, you're going to make a smaller board.
Yes.
And then also, if you're using decoupling capacitors, you can get much smaller loop area by placing the capacitors directly under the package. So you can't get too much closer than that than having the, especially if you're doing like a BGA package or something with pins in the middle of the package, you can't get much better than putting the caps directly underneath the part.
Yeah. Another plus is I think overall your routing gets simpler when you have things on both sides because it's easier to work around having to swizzle pins and things like that.
Yeah, so swizzling is just, that is not like an industry term. It's just what me and Corey say all the time when, let's say you have like a UART between two, microcontrollers and they're on the board. And if you were to place those microcontrollers directly next to each other, like the UART would line up perfectly, like pin to pin, except for the fact that they're actually swizzled or flip-flopped or whatever to where you can't actually run a tray straight from one pin to the other pin. You'd have to cross over them, which is a big pain because then you have to via down or figure out a different way to get there. So that's swizzling. And then absolutely not an industry term. But if you can then just move the package to the bottom side or mirror the package to the bottom side, a lot of times you'll find out that will actually line up the pins to where you can do straight traces to them.
Yeah. And then some cons to having components on both sides of the board.
It's complexity. It's really hard to do if you're doing it at a hobby level.
Yes. Your debug is going to get a lot harder because now you might want to probe two sides of a signal that are on different sides of the board.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking about that. I was just thinking about getting the parts on the board. How are you going to do it? If you got an assembly house, right, that has a pick and place machine and all that stuff and they can run your board through twice, fine, put them on both sides of the board. But if you're at home with either a convection oven or a toaster oven or what's popular for single-sided boards is a hot plate.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to work out.
Yeah.
You go to put parts on one side. All right. You solder them down. Then you try the second side and then your profile is not good and your parts fall off the bottom.
You're pretty much resigned to hand soldering your board if you have components on both sides.
Yeah.
Or at least one side of the board.
Right. And that's time.
Yeah.
And
if you do use a fab house, then your cost is going to go up because now the fab house needs to create two stencils instead of one.
Right. And they got to go two passes usually. Yeah. Through the machines.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a cost, there's complexity. Yeah, there's debug issues because not everything's on the same side of the board. So when you're trying to probe one signal and the other, you got to get up underneath the board, that kind of thing.
Yeah. From my perspective, if this is a hobbyist board, if this is a board I'm doing at home, I'm not running it to a fab house, I am going to have all the components on one side because I will take the extra time to deal with the complexities of the layout. To make it easier to assemble once I get the parts.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not space constrained, put it all on the same side. The only thing is, I mean, of course, if it's a through-hole component, who cares? You're going to hand solder it anyway. A lot of times you can save space by taking your through-hole components and putting them on the bottom side of the board. So, but before you do placement, you need to decide on that.
Yeah, and another important aspect of your component placement is grouping your components together. It's a lot easier to place a group of components in a section of the board and then kind of tweak as you start merging the different groups together. And I know two kind of main ways to pick a component group. One of them is by part number and the other is by net name. So with part number, you know, you can really do whatever you want. A lot of times, if it's based off of the page of the schematic, it's like all your part numbers will start with the page number of the schematic. Or if it's just one really big schematic page, you can kind of pick grouping numbers and all the parts in that group will start with the same number. Or you can just look at net names. Highlight a net and say, okay, everything touching this net is going to be in a group.
Yeah. Well, the way I like to do component placement is to group them in your fundamental building blocks. So typically in your design, you're going to have certain parts of the schematic that do certain basic fundamental things. Like you're going to have either a page or an area of your schematic that's going to do your power supplies. And then you're going to have a page or an area of your schematic that's going to do your microcontrollers and that kind of thing. What I like to do is I start grouping those components and actually laying them out as if they existed entirely alone on an infinite PCB. So when I do my power supplies, I don't think about the fact that they're going to be in some corner of a part of a PCB. What I like to do is pretend that I have a giant PCB and it doesn't matter where it's going to go, and I lay it out as such. Now, that doesn't mean I spread it across the PCB, because that would actually make a bad power supply layout, because you want to reduce your loop area, especially for your switching signals. But don't worry about the fact that your power supply circuit is part of this larger schematic. Just concentrate on the individual building blocks and lay them out as if they existed alone and you were trying to make the best version of just a board that only had a power supply on it. And then same thing when you get to your microcontrollers and your surrounding passives for that, is pretend that that microcontroller exists just by itself. Because what happens is if you don't do it that way, you'll end up making a bunch of bad circuits because you're trying to fit them into some kind of larger schematic. Like you'll be concerned about the fact that, you know, there's a microcontroller near your power supply. So you'll do weird things with the way that you're connecting up your inductors and stuff like that on the power supply. You can definitely group them by the component number or the net names, but even more fundamental than that is what are your basic building blocks of the full schematic. I've seen a lot of people get into trouble when they don't lay out things that way, especially with power supplies.
Yeah, and one of the big things to that style of layout, which actually I like to do as well, is just making sure when you're laying out those individual blocks to clearly kind of denote or mark or have laid out the inputs and outputs to that block. So that way when you are combining them, you kind of have a target of, okay, this is where this guy needs to go to in your interconnect routing. Now, one thing that helps with all of this is draw a block diagram for your board. Once you have all these blocks kind of decided, then just start drawing squares. Make a big square for your board outline and then just start drawing squares as to where you think the functional flow kind of is and make a block diagram, because believe it or not, that's a really good starting point for your actual layout and component placement. If you know generally how the functional flow of your board is going to be, then laying it out becomes a lot simpler.
Yeah, and I'd probably do that after you've done the individual, basic building blocks, and then you need to decide now how do those building blocks all fit together on this board, and you don't want to start just laying them out that way. The block diagram is a great tool to use to figure out how everything's going to fit. And a lot of times you'll find that, let's say you originally do a block diagram and the building block all the way to the top left of the board is actually only going to all these components that you have on the bottom right of the board. So you can see right there, oh, these two circuits only interact with each other, and they're on complete opposite ends of the board. Maybe it would make more sense to both put both of them on the left-hand side. Something like that.
Yeah. You know, this has been very high level about component placement. There is something about component placement that drives Carl insane.
Yeah. Now, it's a personal decision. I can't come at this as I'm completely right and the science completely backs me up on it, because it actually doesn't. The science on this is a personal preference. But if you're going to use decoupling capacitors, for God's sakes, put them near the pin they're supposed to be decoupling.
Yes, I have looked at many layouts with Carl, and he will see one cap off in the middle of the board near nothing that has power on one pin and ground on the other pin.
Right, that's the biggest problem with decoupling capacitors. So this usually occurs, well, it could occur when you're doing the layout, but it occurs more often when somebody else is actually doing the layout off of your schematic. There is a net list that's created when you make your schematic. And that net list basically just says what pin is connected to what pin of one package to another package. It's very much like a net list in SPICE, where it just says this part is connected to this part, and it goes by net names. Now, the problem with decoupling capacitors is that they have two pins, right? One pin is going to be some power rail, and the other pin is usually going to be ground. That doesn't tell you very much. All it tells you is that the capacitor goes from power to ground, but it doesn't tell you that this capacitor is actually supposed to be filtering high frequency noise on pin 7 of your microcontroller. None of that information is available directly by looking at the net list. And usually when you're doing a PCB layout, you'll have the unlaid out nets will show up in some form, right? They'll show up kind of in a spider web kind of thing. Well, for these caps, it's going to point, that spider web is going to point to the closest spot that it can find power and ground. So a lot of times layout guys, or, you know, yourself, if you're not being careful about what this capacitor is actually trying to do, you'll just place it anywhere on the board, because a lot of times you have a power and ground plane. So pretty much anywhere on that board, you can via down to power and via down to ground. But if you put that capacitor all the way to the far left and the component it's actually supposed to be filtering noise for is bottom right, it's going to do nothing for that component. Now, so I think everybody kind of understands decoupling capacitors. There is a bit of evidence to say that if you put the capacitor not directly on the pin, but close to the pin and via down from power to ground, that it'll actually filter just like a regular decoupling capacitor. I don't like doing that. In a perfect world, this is how it works for me. You have a power plane, you have a ground plane, you have a component on the top layer. The power goes from the power plane up through a via, through a net, into a capacitor, and then from that capacitor into the power pin. Okay, it doesn't go up through a via to the pin and then you stub off and go to a cap and then that goes to ground. And it sure doesn't go power up through a via to the cap, back down to ground, nowhere near the pin. And this can really be avoided if you follow the first tip, which is lay out your circuits as if they existed in a giant empty PCB. Because then you'll make sure that you place those decoupling capacitors properly. What usually ends up happening is you forget about the decoupling capacitors, you start routing your signals, and then it's kind of a pain to fit those decoupling capacitors back in, because they always seem to, like, you know, block some signal that you actually previously laid out. So then you kind of fudge it in there and you don't wire it up the perfect way to do it. Now, I will say this, I've seen circuits not work because they didn't have decoupling caps. So whether or not it works perfect, if it's, you know, close to the pin, I don't know. But I have seen circuits not work because people forgot a decoupling capacitor. And I'm just talking like one decoupling cap. They're important. Put them down. Connect them to the pin. Unless you got a white paper that you helped write saying that you don't need to do it.
Yeah, a lot of people kind of take for granted that components will just work when you plug them into power, and they don't think much about the high frequency noise. But it, you know, depending on the circuit, depending on the IC, that high frequency noise can just completely tank its operation, either make it much less efficient or make it not functional at all.
Yeah, and putting a 0.1 UF capacitor down for a decoupling cap is actually the least you can do. Okay, because we haven't talked too much about capacitors on this show yet. I'm hoping if there's any experts in the audience, contact us. I really want to do a whole episode on capacitors, but a 0.1 UF capacitor is not like a magic weapon. It has all kinds of problems depending on what kind of frequency you're actually trying to filter out. It has a bunch of issues with the fact that its capacitance is going to be much lower than its rated value because there's voltage sitting on it. It also has impedance problems because of the package size, all this stuff. But bare minimum, just put a decoupling cap down and do it before you start laying out your signals. Because if you've laid out perfect signals, but your part doesn't work because there's no decoupling caps on it, well then, you know, there goes all that perfect looking 45 degree angle signal stuff you got going on. Doesn't matter because part doesn't work.
Yeah.
Not to get too preachy, which I think I just did, but it's happened to me on numerous occasions. It's
a little touchy. I said, if there's one thing that drives Carl crazy with PCB layout,
yeah,
it's decoupling capacitors. So anyway, what are the, you got any other gotchas right now for component placement?
Yeah, I got one.
Okay.
All right. Think about heat.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That is a good one. So I'm saying this. It sounds facetious. It sounds like I'm saying something extremely obvious, but it is not always the case. Heat rises.
Yeah.
If you put a component on the top of the board, the likely case is a lot of your heat is going to escape into the air. Not all of it. A lot of your heat, some of the heat will also escape into the board. So account for that. If you put a component on the bottom of your board, a lot more of that heat is going to go into the board.
Oh, that's not okay. Yeah, that's good advice. Here's one for me. Now they say that anything over a 1-inch square copper is pretty much gilding the lily, as Dave Jones would like to say, which means the copper on your board will work as a heat sink. But it's really only effective up to about a 1-inch square. After that, it's you're not really gaining any extra. But let's take, for instance, the lonely LDO. Especially if it's a service mount part, you need the copper. And let's say you have a 1-inch square of copper underneath your part. But the thing is, your part is all the way on the edge of the board. So that 1-inch copper starts at the edge of the board and goes in. Well, the problem is heat's going to radiate out in all directions, and the edge of your board is going to get really hot. So if you're dealing with a part that is going to create a lot of heat and you're just relying on the PCB, try to place it at least far enough into your board to where you can get a 1-inch square copper all the way around it, right? So bring it in half an inch from the edge of the board.
Yeah. Along the same vein, if you're even remotely concerned about a part generating heat, leave space around it. Don't pack it in the middle of a whole bunch of circuitry, because one, heat is going to affect the operation of other circuits in the area, especially if you're doing any kind of analog design, right? Especially if you're starting to use like BJTs, things like that, that's extremely sensitive to heat. That's why a lot of times you see them in thermal sensors.
Right.
But the other thing is, if you leave enough room around it, you can put an external heat sink on that chip.
Right.
And not have to worry about it touching other parts.
Now, in the same vein, if you're going to do that, which a lot of parts I suggest you do, like if you put a hub down, like a USB hub, those things get hot. if you're going to do that and you're going to rely on an external heatsink, and they're really cheap, and they have ones that just stick on. What you need to worry about there is package height of the passive components surrounding the part that you're trying to cool. So if your part's only, 0.5 millimeters high, that would actually be a pretty high part.
Yeah.
But if it's 0.5 millimeters high, but the capacitors surrounding it are 0.6 millimeters high, when you go to put that heatsink down, you can end up shorting things out and stuff like that. So a lot of times, if you're going to use those kind of heat sinks, you want low height capacitors, which you can get. You just got to check the package size and the Z height on the parts you're going to put around the component. But don't discount the amount of heat that simple parts can generate. And a cool PCB is a happy PCB, is a well-functioning circuit.
Yeah, don't take it for granted that your LDO, yeah, it's only going from 5 to 3.3, right? That's nothing. At an amp, that's not nothing anymore.
Yeah, and we bring it up now because it really is all placement issues. These things need to be decided on in placement.
Yeah, you got to give these parts that are going to heat up enough room around them, one, to either put an external heat sink, or two, have enough copper in the board around them for that to act as a heat sink.
I think that's it on component placement. I could probably do a whole hour on it, but I think those are the main points I wanted to
make. Yeah, those are definitely some big points. So why don't we move on then? The next big thing is power placement. I would do that before signaling.
Yeah, your power plane designs.
Yes.
Now, if you're doing a simple two-layer board, you don't have this issue. You have a whole nother issue because you're not going to be able to dedicate an entire plane to power. Typically, you're going to need both sides of that board for signals, unless you put jumpers in there, but I haven't seen that being done for a while. So you don't have this problem. Then you have another problem where you need to make sure your grounds all come to like a star point and stuff like that. We're not really talking about that. The price of four-layer PCBs are incredibly cheap now compared to what they were just a few years ago. And if it's my advice, if it's your first couple PCBs, make it easy on yourself. Do a four-layer board so you can afford a power plane and a ground layer. Now, if you're doing more advanced designs like 8-layer and 10-layer boards, you probably don't need any of our advice anyway. And if you want to come on the show and actually give us a bunch of tips for young people, feel free, contact us. But designing power planes is also before you want to do your signal layers. And really, it comes right after doing your major groupings. A lot of times with those power planes, especially around like switching regulators and stuff like that, is when you want to be really careful about your design. And really, it's just mostly to eliminate large loops and reduce the impedance on the switching regulators. Otherwise, it just causes issues. Besides that, on the power side, it's kind of okay to do multiple planes where there's some separation between them. On the ground plane, my personal opinion is just don't split it. I went back and forth with some analog circuit stuff and some acquisition stuff on whether or not to split the planes, the ground plane, because there is some information out there that says that you want to split your digital and analog ground planes so that the digital noise doesn't get onto your analog circuits. And you'll also see on ADCs a lot that they'll actually have different ground pins. They'll have an analog ground pin and a digital ground pin and then like a reference pin. Don't go just by the pin names on ADCs. Google that. You'll actually see that there's really no difference there with the analog digital ground. It doesn't mean you have to do separate grounds and stuff like that. And then on ground planes too, after you lay it out the first time, you're going to have to look at it again after you've started doing placements, especially if you're doing like a four-layer board with simple vias where it's just through-hole vias, because they're going to start turning your ground plane into Swiss cheese, which is completely okay to have a ground plane that's like Swiss cheese. But when we get to signals, it's going to be important to look at how good your ground plane is. And what you really don't want is like little islands in your ground plane that aren't electrically connected to the rest of the ground plane.
Yeah, and actually that's something you want to be careful about with the power planes as well, because a lot of times people don't put as much effort into the routing of the power plane as they do the signal plane, because the power plane is only, what, like 3 or 4 nets, right?
Yeah.
That's nothing, except when you have, you know, 3 different voltages. So let's say you have 5-3-3 and 1-2-5 or something like that, and each of your blocks is not guaranteed to only pull from one power supply. You might have a couple components that, you know, their IO voltage is 3-3, but their core voltage is the 1-2-5. So now you have to make sure that both of those power planes get to that block. It can go downhill real quick in terms of how complex your power plane is going to need to look. And the more complex it gets, the more you have to start worrying about things like power loops and ground loops and things like that. That could just, a ground loop is a giant inductor on your board, and inductors are bad.
Typically, yeah. Now, the other thing too is what I've seen is overzealous power planes. So if you, let's say you have some, like 5 parts, top left-hand side of your board that are all running off of a 1.25 rail, right? And your 1.25 volt power supply is bottom left or something like that. You don't need to make that 1.25 power plane the entire size of your board.
Yeah.
Just group it where it needs to go. It doesn't need to go all the way over to the top right of your board. And a lot of times what you'll do is you'll just, you know, increase the amount of noise that you're injecting onto that power plane for no reason, when really all that plane needed to be is in the area of the parts that were using it. Now, if you're referencing signals off of that power plane, which typically you wouldn't do, you'd reference them off of the ground plane, then yeah, okay, spread it out. But a lot of times it's actually better to keep your power planes as big as they need to be, not huge.
Yeah, although a lot of engineers I've seen fall into the trap of, I must utilize every square inch of my board, otherwise I'm a bad engineer. Not necessarily. I mean, if you've grouped everything together and you have your section for this power rail, your section for this power rail, and you still have a bunch of open space on that plane, just fill it with something. Just extend one of your power planes out. I mean,
I don't know. I mean, I'm of a different mind with that. I don't think you need to fill it out. But, you know, personal preference, right? If it was me, I would just leave the power plane as small as it could be versus spreading it all the way out. And then if you really want to fill that area, one of the things we're going to talk about later is thieving, which will fill that area, which is just going to help with manufacturability. So that's a lot. I see people making these big power planes for manufacturability reasons. The fact that they don't want just a large amount of copper on one side, like on the left side of the board, because it starts messing with the manufacturability of the PCB. But that doesn't mean that you have to spread the one plane all the way across. You can add these little islands of copper to help with manufacturability.
Yeah.
So like I said, there's no hard, fast rule on that. It's kind of personal preference, but
yeah,
that's the way I like it.
So along the same vein, when we're talking about manufacturability and power planes, one thing about PCB design is deciding the, I guess polarity is not exactly the right word, but is your layer going to be a positive layer or a negative layer? And we're not talking about voltage.
Yeah, we're talking about the what your shapes or polygons or fills are actually going to be. A lot of times the shape is actually going to be where copper won't be. And it's usually because of the PCB package, the CAD package. Some CAD packages, they automatically fill around vias and that kind of thing. And to do that, they want a negative layer. Now, I typically don't work with negative layers. It's kind of, I don't know, messes me up a bit. So I do all positive layers. I would probably suggest to start out that way too. Just do positive layers where the thing, the polygon you lay down is actually going to be copper. But if you're working off of someone else's design, or, you know, you've inherited this PCB from somebody, just be aware that it could actually be a negative layer. So when the Gerbers are produced, it's actually going to show the opposite of what you're expecting it to show.
Yeah. And the reason negative layers exist, are from the manufacturing standpoint. How PCBs are manufactured is the entire layer of copper is placed down and then it's etched away based on the mask. So if you're using a negative layer, you're removing a lot less copper, which will speed up the process and also make it cheaper. So there are a lot of times when if you are making, you want to make a ton of boards, then maybe it's worth investigating using negative layer.
Yeah, and I guess really that would call your fab house. That's what I would do. Just give them a call. They'll answer. They'll, you know, if you're trying to make their job easier, they're going to answer your question.
Yeah.
But I typically don't use negative layers because it's just annoying. Oh, so also on your power planes and that kind of thing, you need to connect to those power planes. And usually what you end up doing is you have your components on the top and then you via down to them. So from your signal layer, you via down to your power plane. The thing I just wanted to point out here is just know that your vias, especially when you're dealing with power, they have a maximum amount of current capacity. And they also introduce some series resistance and some series inductance. So really, I just want to say, if you're trying to push 4 amps into a part, don't use one little via to go from your power plane up to your part.
Yeah, usually the rule of thumb is like half an amp per via or something like that.
That's what I use.
But those rules of thumb are just completely out of left field. I mean, you could do a experiment where you try and run as much current through a via as you want, and it might fail after a couple amps, not a half an amp. Because, I mean, there are a lot of factors in there. How much copper you're using, the size of the via, all that.
Yeah, and you can plug your vias, right? I mean, if you want to slightly increase their current capacity, you stick a wire in there and solder and all that stuff. I mean, it's been shown that it does help. But if you do multiple vias going down to the power plane, you're going to reduce your resistance because it's all going to be in parallel. And you're going to be able to handle more current, but also you're going to reduce the internal temperature of your PCB. So we're back to the whole temperature thing.
Yeah, and honestly, if you're to the point where you're not sure if you can afford putting another couple of vias down, you need to go back to your component placement phase and look at that.
Well, I mean, it depends how tight your design is. I don't want to say that it's, you know, never going to happen to where you can't fit another via in there. But if you can't fit another via in there and you look around and there's a whole bunch of empty space that you're not utilizing, then yeah, maybe you want to go back to your block diagram or something like that and try to see if you can fit these components in a little bit better. But
I'm just saying from a perspective that, you know, if you stick to the half an amp per via rule and you need to put multiple vias down because you're trying to pass 4 amps, go back and look at your component placement if you can't fit it in. Even if you are tightly constrained, if you're trying to pass 4 amps through where you physically can't because you don't have enough space, well, your board's not going to work. You need to go back and revisit your component placement anyway.
Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to point out is that pretty much all circuits are loops. So if you have 5 vias going to a capacitor, you know, from the power plane up to a cap, you should probably put five vias going from that cap to the ground plane. So I see that happening a lot where people will use a whole bunch of vias on one side of a component, but not a whole bunch of vias on the other side of the component. I've seen it a couple times with current sense resistors, which are, you know, used to measure how much current's going through the circuit. And it'll go from plane to plane, and one side of the cap will have like 5, 6, 7, 8 vias on it, and the other side will have one.
Yeah, which is a problem when you're trying to measure current in the multiple amps range.
Right. So the more vias, the merrier. Now, as far as via size goes, so I once emailed a fab house because, you know, you can like pick whatever size via you want. I mean, you can type in whatever number all the way out to like the 8th decimal place in a lot of these CAD packages. So I emailed the fab house and I'm like, hey, you know, I could pick whatever I want, but, you know, what drill bits do you have on hand, right? And they basically said, look, we don't care. So I'd like to give you advice on, like, if you should always use, you know, increments of 0.1 millimeters or something like that on your vias. But honestly, I don't know. I know that some vias are actually chemically etched instead of using end mills or drill bits or whatever they're using. I guess then it really doesn't matter because it's just based on the mask. But, you know, if you really want to know, just ask the fab house how they make their vias. And then you can decide there. Now, the bigger the via, the more the current capacity. So you can go that route. The lower the inductance and series resistance, which is always good. So I guess put the biggest via you can down. But besides that, I don't really have any advice on sizes of vias.
Yeah, I always just, whatever the default size that whatever the CAD package gives me is usually what I stick with, unless it seems that it's too big and I can't fit my components where I want to.
Right.
So.
Will their PCB be laid out, or will they meet with disaster? Tune in next week for the exciting conclusion. In the meantime, send us an electronic mail using show@thesparkgap.net or find us on the Twitterverse @SparkGapPodcast. Or you can go to our World Wide Web website, thesparkgap.net, and leave us an editorial comment.